Hello, I'm Kieran Valley.
And I'm Kate Valley.
And this is Friday Night at Blockbuster, the podcast about our favorite movies from the 2000s.
So this week, Kieran, I saw something on Instagram.
Okay.
And immediately...
Something related to movies?
Something related to movies. Okay. And immediately thought of you.
Okay. So your algorithm is slowly turning.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You're slowly making strides here. So it was a fan voting system, whatever, on greatest Hollywood directors of all time.
Okay. Okay. So, like, do I want to know who, like, who did they have?
Okay. So at the bottom, so they had Quentin.
At the beginning.
Yeah. At the beginning, they had Quentin Tarantino versus Stanley Kubrick.
Oh, God. Okay.
So they had Quentin Tarantino, Stanley Kubrick, Christopher Nolan, Francis Ford Coppola, Steven Spielberg, James Cameron, Martin Scorsese, and Ridley Scott.
Okay.
So now looking at it again, it wasn't a head-to-head between those guys. It was just people had to vote for their favorites.
Oh, okay. So they just had to like write in the next...
Yeah.
Okay.
So I thought that was a head-to-head between people, and I was like, well, that would be hard to compare styles.
Well, it would be... Yeah. Okay.
We'll start with that. So then we get up to our final four.
Okay.
So they have Christopher Nolan.
Yeah.
Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah.
Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
And Martin Scorsese.
Yeah, not surprising.
Do you want to know who made it out as top two in that group, or do you...
I would say it's probably Tarantino versus Nolan.
No. So you've got Christopher Nolan, right? And okay. Then Steven Spielberg.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So who's the winner?
Out of those two, like, it should be Steven Spielberg. I can only imagine that because it's on Instagram that Christopher Nolan ended up winning.
Yes, he did.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Okay. I love Christopher Nolan's movies. We are about to do a, like, best of the year episode where your favorite movie, best movie of the year, and my favorite movie of the year sort of not goes head to head, but like we just talk about both.
Yeah, we just revisit them.
And like, spoiler warning, I'm not picking my favorite movie of the year. My favorite movie of the year is Oppenheimer. I think Christopher Nolan has like
put a
marker down as like, this will go down as one of the better movies. It's probably the best movie he's ever made. It might not necessarily be my favorite yet, but I can only imagine it's going to get there. Like, he really did something special with Oppenheimer. Basically grew up with his movies.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Like, we're a Nolan family.
We're fans. Like, I love even the movies of his that I don't like. I'm still like, yeah, it's pretty good though. It's pretty good. There is no way.
He's the greatest of all time. He's the
greatest Hollywood director of all time. There's not a chance. There's not a chance that he is the greatest of all time. I would say that he has, like, I don't even know if he's made a true classic yet. Like, okay. A true, in 50 years, we're still going to be studying this movie.
Maybe Oppenheimer could be it.
Possibly.
Maybe.
It's hard to say. Like, it's a bit recent. But, like...
Is he in your top five?
I don't think he'd make my top 10.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Hollywood directors of all time. All time. First of all, the list, like... Stanley Kubrick, I guess, shout out to him. He's the old timer on there who was making movies in like the 60s, but there's nobody before that.
There's also no females, which like...
Yeah, okay, but the no females thing gets you into a tough history lesson with Hollywood of like, they just wouldn't let women make movies until quite recent. You know what I mean?
That's true.
So there are definitely female directors that I would happily put up against any of those guys in terms of like, are they good directors? Once you get into a conversation of greatest Hollywood directors, like the best female director of all time maybe is Catherine Bigelow, and like she's directed like seven movies because they don't let her make movies.
Okay, so it's hard to kind of have them in the same...
Like once you get into the conversation of greatest, do you mean greatest as in like the best to ever do it? or do you mean greatest in terms of like the impact that they've had? You know what I mean? Like, so like Sofia Coppola, I'd happily put Sofia Coppola's movies, her best movies, up against her father's best movies. There's not a whole lot in like in it for me. Like, you take out sort of maybe Godfather 1 and 2, it's a pretty even heat at that point. You know what I mean? Between the two of them. So like, it's not a skill thing with women, but it is just a sort of like, because they have not been able to have the impact. They've not been put in position to have the impact.
They don't have the volume or...
They're not quite there yet. You know, given another 20 years, like Greta Gerwig is on her way.
Yeah.
Fast on her way. They're all white men. We could say that.
Yeah.
So that's not great. You know, like Spike Lee's not on there. Ang Lee's not on there. Ang Lee has 2 Oscars for Best Director. There's only like 4 people in history who've ever done that, and he's one of them. Like, so he should probably be on there. There's also like, I don't know, you get into Hollywood, like there's a lot of guys who do like only sort of not indie, but like they're not necessarily working in the Hollywood system in the same way. And so maybe that disqualifies them. So like somebody like David Lynch, is a great director. He's not making $100 million movies.
Yeah.
So like how are you quantifying it all? But yeah, I think any conversation of greatest Hollywood directors that doesn't come down to Martin Scorsese versus Stanley Kubrick is like wrong.
So those would be your top two.
You've veered off path already, and you've come up with the wrong answer.
So those would be your top two?
Oh, like with a bullet. Okay. Spielberg is certainly in the conversation for longevity and, you know, the impact that he's had. I think the fact that Martin Scorsese continues to make like just unbelievably great movies in his 6th decade, whereas, you know, Spielberg is on a bit of a comeback, a bit of an upturn, but there was a long time there where Spielberg was like, there was like 10 or 15 years where I was sort of like, I think it's over. I think it might be finished for Steven here. But yeah, I don't know how you overlook those two. Like, I understand that it's an Instagram crowd voting for this. So I understand that that's probably how we got to Christopher Nolan. But like, everything Christopher Nolan does is indebted to Stanley Kubrick. So like, you can't really overlook what he's done to get us where we are today. Tough poll. Not great. To end up with Nolan as the greatest Hollywood director of all time. Tough one. James Cameron's interesting too. Like, he's only made like 7 movies, but 3 of his movies are in the top 4 all time at the box office. So like, sort of like, yeah, it's pretty good record, really.
Yeah. So, because his is like Avatar and...
The 2 Avatars and Titanic. I think those are 3 of the top 4 ever.
Okay.
In terms of money. So like, how much does that factor in? I'm sure Hollywood would devote him the greatest of all time.
Hollywood would like him.
Makes them a lot of money. So I'm sure they like him. Yeah, I don't know. Tough pull. I don't know if I'd necessarily have him in my top 10, but he'd probably be higher than Nolan, I think. You catch me on the right day. Is Soderbergh.
Okay.
Another Steven. And today we're actually going back to August 18th, 2000 to talk about his movie, Aaron Brockovich. So this was a first time watch for you, Kate.
Yeah.
What did you know about this movie? Like, what kind of reputation did it have for you before you sat down and watched it?
Quite literally nothing. Like, I didn't really know the story at all.
But like, you didn't even know anything about like Julia Roberts?
No, like I just knew she was in it.
Oh, okay.
I don't think I knew that this is when she got her Oscar, and it was kind of the long-awaited Oscar and the well-deserved Oscar by this point and stuff. So yeah, it was really just, I've seen the poster, and every time we'd been talking about kind of movies from the 2000s, it was kind of on the list, but we were like, oh, well, no, this is a better week to do this movie or whatever. And so when we were talking about just the last kind of couple weeks of the year and how we were going to play them out, we hit this week and we were just like, well, like, we can't do... I was trying to push for 2 Christmas movies, but that quickly got nixed.
It was never, ever going to happen. You gave me one Halloween movie, I'll give you one Christmas movie.
Yeah, but to your one Halloween movie, you did sneak in two.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we pointed out afterwards, Monsters, Inc. is also a home invasion movie. So, like, really, there was three.
That's pushing it. But you cannot label Monsters, Inc. a horror movie just because it involves home invasion.
Well, it's horror to some kids, I'm sure. But for this movie, yeah, I didn't really know much about it. So after watching it, I really liked it. And I did sit there being like, I don't know how me and Kieran are going to have a conversation about this movie.
Well, I think
I'm really glad you're leading this week.
Yeah, well, I think any conversation around Aaron Brockovich, I don't think we've actually done a movie. We'd have to go back and look. I don't think we've done a movie where it's like the name of the character is the title and it's all about that character. And it's like a show-stopping performance from the actor. And it's like the whole conversation kind of just like points directly at Julia Roberts. Like it's kind of all there is to talk about, really. And so, yeah, like, so you enjoyed the movie. I can only imagine that you enjoyed her performance.
I thought she did such a great job. I loved from the first scene where she is clearly, where are they supposed to be, kind of?
I think it's like a hospital.
No, but like they're down, like, are they supposed to be kind of Texas
area? Oh, it's like California.
Or California.
Yeah, it's like outside Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So like her with her big hair.
Yeah.
And kind of the skimpy clothes and just the transformation she goes through during the movie. But then that also reflects in her hair changing and the clothes changing and kind of the way she ends up carrying herself and things like that. Like, she just did such a good job.
I think she's, like, absolutely dynamite.
Like.
Yeah. this is, like, she was already arguably the biggest name draw in Hollywood at the time. Like, she was making $20 million a movie and things like that. But, like, this is a pure star-making performance role where it's like, I'm going to put you at the center of every single scene, every single shot, and, you know, you're just going to continually hit it out of the park because the script is working for her, the character is working for her, all the supporting characters are, like, there to, like, really prop her up and be like, let's fucking go there, like, let's do it. And you know, Julia Roberts is just incredible. She's incredible.
Like, I'm looking kind of back at her page now, seeing, like, what have I seen her in. The ones I always remember her in is, like, the Ocean movies.
Yeah.
Or, like, I love Mona Lisa Smile, and so I've seen her in that. Stepmom is also one of my favorites. But this is, like, one of the early ones of hers that I've seen. And it's not even early in her catalog.
No,
it's just early for me.
It's just early for you. Yeah. Well, you have a little bit of an aspersion to sort of early 90s, and we've already talked about pre-90s, like, that's not happening for you. But yeah, like, she sort of, there, like, there's a couple of movies in here that I haven't watched yet because there's rom-com-ish movies that, you know,
just not your thing.
Yeah, they don't really appeal to me. But, like, she sort of, I think, blew up on the scene with Mystic Pizza, which is like 88, 89-ish.
Okay.
And I think she just, like, she comes on screen with that huge fucking smile, like the big red hair, the big personality, the big laugh. And you're just like, who the fuck is that? And then, like, the ball is rolling.
Yeah.
And, like, a year or two later, she gets Pretty Woman, which is just the biggest thing.
Yeah, I really need to go and see it.
Pretty Woman is pretty great.
Yeah.
It's pretty awesome. It's like, it's not similar to this in sort of like tone or anything like that, but it is similar in terms of like, oh wow, like they caught lightning in a bottle here. And she clearly knew, like, this is it. If I do it with this role in this movie, fuck, I get to, like, name my price. I get to name my movies from here on out. And she does it. She absolutely does it.
Does she have any kind of duds?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. So, like,
I guess I only see her good ones so far. So
she kind of, like, she kind of comes out of the gate real hard, real fast. And then when she becomes, like, this huge, huge A-list star, some of the movies that she ends up making are, like, not very good. And so, like, I watched Sleeping with the Enemy the other night. It's not great. It's whatever. She makes a couple poorly chosen I think, poorly chosen roles. So she does like Mary Riley, which is about, I think it's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde's like housewoman. Like the woman who like looks after the house or whatever for him.
Okay. Like the housekeeper?
The housekeeper.
Okay.
And the movie's told from her perspective, but she has to do like, I think she's trying to do a Scottish accent in that movie.
Oh.
And Julia Roberts can't do accents. That's like actually the one thing that she can't do. And yeah, it's not very good. And then she very quickly after that does Michael Collins, where she plays the Irish love interest to Michael Collins, where again, you're just like, no, this didn't work. Like, Michael Collins is a good movie because she's like a supporting character, so it doesn't really
affect the overall movie. Yeah, okay.
But she sticks out really badly.
See, whereas I've seen that movie, I need to go back and rewatch it as well, but I don't remember her in it at all. So
exactly. So like, that's not a great endorsement. She does other things, I think, that like, you know, people might have like nostalgic feelings towards, but like on the whole have not held up in any real way. So like, she teams up with Richard Gere again. So it's her and Richard Gere in Pretty Woman, and they team up again in Runaway Bride, which I think people went and saw because it was the two of them, and then were like, oh, this is not as good. And then, you know, sort of dismissed. But like, the thing I think with the 90s run that she goes on is like every couple of years, there's a big hit. There's a big sort of reminder of like,
she can do it.
I can still do this. So you get things like, you know, My Best Friend's Wedding and Notting Hill then shows up at the end. And then you get Erin Brockovich, which is like obviously made in 99. It comes out in 2000. And you're just like, yeah, like when she is teamed up with a good script, good director and a good role, there's very few people I think that you'd rather have working for you. You know what I mean? So yeah, I think like she's absolutely dynamite. And like the character of Erin Brockovich is like tough, and you know, she's calls it like she sees it, and she's a bit like unpolished.
Which I really liked.
But like all of that works. All of that works. And Julia Roberts plays into all of it. And you get like, you get glimpses of a backstory, which are probably not very nice and not very sort of warm and fuzzy. And when we first meet her, she does have these like walls up because she's clearly been sort of maybe mistreated or what have you in the past. And so we're meeting her, and like her back is up already. Like she is ready to tear, strip off the world. And then she gets in with Ed in this legal firm. And you're sort of like, oh, like given the chance and given the position and the ability to sort of be like, here's a job that you can do, which is basically like she's just talking to people.
And that's like,
that's kind of all she's doing.
From the beginning, you kind of sit there and you're like, she's smart.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
She will figure out, because I think she, in the beginning at the job interview, she talks about the various jobs she's done. And she is kind of a little all over the place, a little doing of everything. But clearly she was doing a good job at them. Just life happened and she had to leave and things like that. But she was smart and she picked them all up. And so when she starts at the law firm, at first I was kind of like, oh, you're not going to do well. But sure enough, yeah, it's just her talking to people. It's and she her can her connect with people.
Exactly,
so.
Exactly. She has those people skills. She has those like soft skills to sort of be able to communicate on somebody's level. And especially once we, you know, we'll get into the actual story here. But like the people that they do meet, like she has way more in common with them than any of the lawyers in the firm do.
Yeah.
And so you can instantly see, like, she immediately is able to sympathize. She's immediately able to empathize. Whereas the lawyers show up and it's kind of all business to them because that's what it is.
I need the dates and the times and no emotion and
exactly.
This. And...
But she's sitting down. She's having coffee. She's having bundt cake.
Yeah.
She's, you know, she's making actual connections, which then, you know, I think Ed, more so maybe than the other lawyers, comes to sort of realize to be like, oh, like that's the bread and butter of this case and maybe of this whole business, is that like they like Erin and Erin works for me. And so therefore, I get their business.
Yeah.
And like, that's kind of it. 1 + 1 = 2.
Yeah. And like, if she was more of a lawyer type, they wouldn't have signed on.
Exactly.
And,
they like, wouldn't come.
It would have been
that
pro bono case and done.
And done. And moving on. Exactly. I think the thing that I noticed a lot on this watch, I'd only ever seen it once before. So I think I saw this. Again, we'll show it at Letterboxd here. But I couldn't remember when I had seen it. I knew that it wasn't that long ago.
Oh, it's like a recent-y watch.
Okay. And when I went on, it was one of the first movies I logged on Letterboxd.
Oh, wow.
Because it was like, are you logging again? Are you writing another review? And I was like, oh, I didn't even know I'd written the first one. So I've only watched this 4 years ago or whatever. So I obviously remembered quite a bit, but I couldn't remember sort of the nitty-gritty of certain scenes and whatnot. But I think the thing that I sort of latched onto this time through was how well structured the story kind of plays out. Like, this is based on a true story. I'm sure that there are lots of liberties taken with how this all unfolded in real life. But what I like is that we meet her and her life is an absolute mess.
Yeah.
And she's trying to get a job. We then watch her as she gets the job. And immediately as she gets the job and you think, okay, that part of her life is like being put together. That's when we get the big issue of the movie. Like, it's almost immediate to sort of be like, okay, now like that's taken care of. Now it's into this huge environmental disaster. And like, that's going to be the issue for the rest of the way through. But the thing that I liked was that like every 10 or 15 minutes or so, she gets a kind of what I eventually was sort of like, oh, these are just like fuck you moments.
Okay.
Where she gets like a speech or she gets a scene with somebody where she like, it doesn't really matter where she is in the story or what she's doing. Somebody somewhere like challenges her and she gets to like put them in their place.
Yeah.
With a rant. And then it's sort of like, fuck yeah. Like, like that's how every time it happened, that's how I felt. I was like, fucking right, Aaron. Like,
well done.
Well done. It's like, and she gets it like repeatedly. She gets like 6 of them throughout the movie. And she gets them with the lawyers and she gets them with some of the people. She gets them with the boyfriend. She gets them with the secretary.
Oh, like, yeah.
She's
rough.
She's a bit of a hostile co-worker, but
I don't know if I would have liked working with her.
Well, I think what I sort of was also noticing about Aaron was that there's like those players in sports where when you play against them, you're just like, God fucking damn it. Like, this guy sucks to play against. Like, he's such a pest. You know, he just gets under your skin. He knows how to sort of, you know, weed his way.
He knows what the move is to get around you or whatever.
But it's not even that. It's not even that they beat you necessarily with skill. It's that they beat you with, like, you know, when I was playing soccer, like, a guy would, like, stand on your ankle or he'd be pulling at your jersey or they're constantly shit-talking and you're just like, God damn it. Like, just leave me alone. Let me play this game. But, of course, that's what they're there to do. Like, they're there to make you stop playing the game and start focusing on them.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what Aaron is.
Yeah, that's true.
She's just such a pest. But the thing with these people is there's always that voice in the back of your head that says, as annoying as they are to play against, you always want them on your team.
Yeah.
Because if they're on your team,
they leave you alone.
They leave you alone, but they're also working for you. And it's like, that's what I thought Aaron was this time through. I was like, oh, she's the pest. Where as soon as she's on Ed's team, she's fucking great because now she's going after who Ed wants to go after. But it does take them a minute to sort of get on the same page and get on the same wavelength where he can see her sort of benefits.
Yeah, well, like, so when she gets the case and is looking over it and goes to somebody else in the office and is, well, why is there blood samples and why is there this? And their woman's kind of like, you've been here long enough. If you don't know how to do the job, like, I'm not going to do it. In the back of my head, I was just like, well, how long has she been at this job? Because, I'd be curious about that. And she goes to Ed and, oh, I want to investigate this a little bit more. And sure. She disappears for a week and comes back and all of her stuff's packed up.
They fired her.
And they were just like, well, we thought you took off and were having fun.
Yeah.
Or whatever. And she's like, no, I was working. Like, I called you guys. I told you that. And stuff. And I was sitting there being like, yep, that would annoy me too. If I was her out there kind of kicking ass, like trying to do my job and trying to get better and everything like that. And to come back to work and have people think I've done nothing.
Yeah.
Would annoy the shit out of me. So.
Well, I do like that every time Aaron seems to get a win in one direction. So like there's kind of the story with the water and the environmental stuff, like that's the big story. And then the side story is kind of her family life and things like that. But every time she gets a win in like one arena or the other, she immediately gets a loss
in the other side.
In the other side.
Yeah.
And so like, you know, she meets this nice neighbor guy and he says, oh, I can look after your kids so you can go do this job that you're falling in love with and, you know, seem to be doing a good job with. And she's sort of like, okay, great. Like, you know, I've met somebody nice and they're doing a nice thing and that's going to take care of that. And then she immediately gets fired.
Yeah.
and then, you know, once she starts killing it at the job and starts coming up with all this evidence and meeting all these people and getting the bigger and bigger and bigger case, that's when the guy's like, yeah, I'm going to take off. Like, I'm kind of done with this now. Like,
yeah, I'm done being your maid babysitter.
And it's like, oh my God. And I think what that ultimately does, first of all, it kind of keeps the movie sort of rocking and rolling, where it's sort of like, you know, this isn't going to be just a straight line. This is going to be bumpy. This is going to be a little rocky. And, you know, there's highs and lows and all that sort of stuff. And it's like, it's good storytelling. I think what it also does, though, is at the end of the movie, when she gets the big win, you feel it.
Yeah.
Because you're just like, we leave on the win. We don't get another loss immediately behind it. So we get to sit in the win and we understand, like, oh, this is nice. Like,
I think for me, the back and forth was kind of nice because it was all like small little wins and losses. Yeah. Whereas if she had only won throughout the entire movie, I would just say be sitting there being like, well, they're going to lose the case then. Like,
right.
If you built this up so high,
yeah,
and there's only ever been wins, she gets the guy loves her, she loves the guy, she keeps getting the evidence and just building up, I would be sitting there being like, this is going to crash and burn. The guy's going to like ditch her, get her pregnant, and then leave. She's going to lose the case. She's going to lose the job. Like, I would just sit there being like,
when is the shoe going to
drop? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the back and forth was kind of a little just easier to watch. So
I do feel like it kind of gives the whole movie a, like an energy of like, we're up and down, up and down, up and down. But it's not that quick that you're getting kind of whiplash. It is, you know,
subtle.
Yeah, like, okay, she's doing a good job at work, and then the boyfriend leaves. And then, you know, this happens, and then this happens. And, you know, it's just a nice sort of flow to this whole movie. And, like, I was sitting there just watching. I mean, like, Soderbergh is just, like, he's just in his element.
Yeah. What else has he...
Well, he did all the Oceans movies.
Oh, yes. Okay.
That's... So, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, and he did the Oceans movies, like, immediately after this. It's obviously not the same as the Ocean. That's like a heist movie. It's a big team up movie. This is like one woman on the road. It's not an eco thriller, but it's a little bit of like an environmental, ecological, legal drama, we'll say.
Okay. I was going to say, I don't know if I've ever heard the term eco thriller before.
Oh, well, next week you're in for a surprise then. But I had like the same feelings. It sort of had the same tone, I think, as some of the Ocean's movies, where it's like, this is pretty lighthearted. There are some jokes. It's pretty, like, I am laughing.
Yeah.
It's maybe a little bit more serious than the Ocean's movies, because, like, ultimately, those, like, have no stakes. Whereas this has, like, families and families and families who are constantly sick and dying and whatnot. But, like, it's just that ability to kind of, even when things get tough, even when things get hard, you know, he's able to sort of be like, it's okay. Like, we're going to, this is good. This is all right. Like, we're going to come out of this.
Yeah.
How did you find Aaron Brockovich, the character, we'll say, maybe not the actual person. We don't know the actual person,
but how they wrote her.
Yeah. Aaron Brockovich, the character as a mother. What did you think of the whole portrayal of Aaron as a mother?
I felt like so sad for her all the time because at the start, with like her childcare. Clearly she had the older neighbor next door who she must have given a little bit of money to, I would say. But the older woman didn't really mind. Like, she was kind of helping out. So that was kind of nice. And then the guy moves in and he's got the motorcycle and you are just there being like, I know, like, that sucks. Like, if you've just got kids down to sleep and somebody on the street turns on their motorcycle, you are like there being like, shut it off. Like, do not wake up these kids right now. And then she gets the other babysitter who just drops her kids at the house when nobody was home. Like, my heart would have stopped if I went to go pick up my kid and they weren't there. And then I go home and I find them in the house. And luckily the guy was a nice guy and kind of was like, well, I took them. He could have been an asshole and just been like, yeah, no, the two kids are in there with the baby. I don't know. They're doing something. And stuff. And so you just see her the entire time just wanting to do good for them. Like, that's why she's looking at these jobs. That's why she goes to the job and semi begs Ed without begging Ed to give her the job.
It's such a good scene. It's such a good scene because she like chews him out and then very quietly is like, please don't
make me beg.
Make me beg. Like, please don't. She's like, if it doesn't work out in a week or two, you can fire me. But just like, don't make me beg. Don't throw me out. Just let me do this.
Let me prove it to you. Yeah. Like, I can prove to you that I will be helpful.
Yeah, such a good scene.
And stuff. And the older, I think the boy must have been the oldest.
Yeah.
And him just kind of being, him in one scene saying to her, like, yeah, you were here for dinner last night, but you were always reading. Like, we just want you to be here and be with us and be present in the moment that we're in and stuff. And I'm just there being like, yeah, like, I see that some days with Briar. Like, she just wants to play and I'm trying to find a house or I'm trying to find daycare or something for her. And it's like, I need 5 minutes to do this and then I'm all yours. But I need that 5 minutes first and she doesn't get that 5 minutes yet. And so, like, when she gets the win at the end and you kind of are there being like, she's got the money for the nanny. She's got the nice car now. It's not even that nice of a car. It's just a new car.
It's just a new car that probably works.
And stuff, and you're just there being like, she probably loves that they won the case and all of that, but like, she's now set her kids up and that's what's important to her. So
I just like that in a movie like this. So, like, obviously Soderbergh is a man. I do tend to find it obviously a bit more common when the filmmaker is a woman, but I always, like, I watch a lot of these kind of movies where they're, you know,
the title character is the main character.
Well, but it's more about like the job takes over their life.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then, you know, like, there are definitely other things in their lives, but, you know, we don't see them or they're not that important. The job is the important thing, right? Like, I read a lot about detectives. I read a lot of detective fiction. And it's like every story starts the same. Like, they have a house plant and then they get a job and they go off and do the job for months and months and they come back and the house plant's dead. And it's like, yeah, there's no other thought in their mind except that job.
Yeah.
And what I tend to find, sort of not in every case, but in most cases, is when it's a male main character that we're following in a story like this, like, the family and the personal life, like, just don't even come into the story at all unless they are, like, threatened.
Yeah.
By, you know, if he's going after a big corporation and then he gets the phone call, like, you know, we're watching you and we're watching your family. And then he's like, oh, fuck, I got my family out of here. Like,
yeah.
That's kind of the only time that they come into the story. More often than not, we're just following this guy on the job. But, like, when I was watching this, I was thinking a lot of that movie She Said from last year with the two journalists.
Oh, yes.
Where, like, it's not that the family are that big of a storyline or whatever. Like, we've already said, like, in this movie, the case is the main story. Her family life is definitely the second most important thing in the story. But there's just enough scenes and shots and details thrown in there. We're sort of just like, oh yeah, like, she has to be a mom too. Like,
yeah.
You know, she doesn't get time off from feeding the kids. And, like, there's all those shots of her, like, in bed cradling the baby while she's reading papers. And you're just like, yeah, because nobody else is going to do that. So she needs to do both.
Or, like, I think it was like a 4th of July picnic or...
Yeah, I think it was, but it was like a picnic for the people that they were trying to get to sign up.
And
yeah,
stuff, yeah, yeah. But so like it was that, it was kind of, well, here's a nice day for the family to all be out and be together and in the sun and stuff. But she's got to hand out pamphlets and...
She can't play.
She can't play.
Yeah.
And then she finally decides, well, I think it's time for us to go. Like, the baby's half asleep or whatever. And somebody comes and says, well, actually, I have something I want to talk to you about the plant. And it's kind of like, sorry, family, you guys go on ahead. I've got to stay and talk to this person about, you know, the case.
Yeah, so. Exactly. Yeah, like, I just think, like, it just puts a little different spin on a story that, like, you've already said you don't know what an eco-thriller is. But, no. But, like, you've seen movies like this where, you know, the lawyer or the journalist or the cop has to, like, go out and gather evidence and, like, talk to people and sort of, you know, piece this puzzle together so that at the last scene they can sort of drop the hammer and, you know, win the day or whatever. Like, you've seen that before.
Oh, yeah.
Having a, like...
Having a mom do it is different,
like,
for you?
Yeah, just, like, having a woman, having a mom, just if you then explore that dynamic as well, like, it just immediately gives you something fresh to stand out from the hundreds of cop movies we get every year,
yeah,
where cops are doing the exact same thing that Aaron Brockovich is doing.
Yeah, I think what was nice with this one is, although she meets the guy and the guy is super helpful and stuff, like, she is a single mom.
Oh yeah,
she is a single mom of three. I do find sometimes with the guy version of this, they always have a wife at home.
Yeah, just
or
like
a or a partner at home who is just kind of being like, I'll hold down the family.
Yeah.
I've got the family. Don't worry about us. You go do your job. Or like, she doesn't have that second person. Like, yeah, the guy is there and he's great, but she is the mom. She is the mom of these three kids. He's not the dad.
Well, I think it would be interesting too. Like, I think it obviously brings up sexist questions and misogynistic questions. Like, even if she was married to this guy and he was the dad, I think watching the movie, you would still have those questions of like, well, she's not a very good mom
because
we don't see her hanging out with the kids.
You don't see her putting them to bed anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You would have those questions of like, whereas you do not have those questions when it is
a guy. Nope.
And you know that he's got a wife at home. You're sort of like, oh yeah, well, like, we're introduced to the wife so that any question we have about the family, we can be like, well, the wife can handle it.
Yeah.
The wife can take care of it. Whereas with Aaron Brockovich, like, this guy and her, like, a pretty stable relationship for basically the entire movie. But they constantly remind you of, like, yeah, she's a mom. Like, she's in charge of these children. And, like, yes, he's helping out and, like, babysitting. But, like, he's not their dad and he's not her husband. And, like, you know what I mean? Like, we need to remind you that, like, she is doing both.
Yeah, the few times she has to bring them to... the water document
place.
Whatever that was, the records place. And the three kids are there with her. Or, like, I think she brings them sometimes to people's houses and for, like, the interviews and the depositions and stuff like that. You are just there being like, these poor kids. Like,
and
they clearly don't want to be here.
No.
But there's quite literally nobody else for them to go to. So.
Well, I think, like, the kids are used enough where it's sort of like, okay, I get the picture that, like, they have a little bit of an understanding of what's going on and they're kind of upset and disappointed that their mom is not really around in the same way that she was before, but they never really let any of the kids have like a hissy fit or anything like that. Cause like, I think that would sort of be like, first of all, you'd be asking a lot of child actors to be like, can you not be annoying in this? Like, can you throw a hissy fit, but also not be like, fuck that kid.
Yeah.
So I think they never ask the kids to do that, which I think is a good idea.
I think the biggest moment for the kids is the boy in the bed when he's kind of just like, we want you to be here and be with us.
And you can understand that.
And like, you totally,
because
like, at some point in everybody's life, you have had that thought about your parents being like, I just want you to be present with us in this moment. But I think then they gave him such a great scene a few scenes later when he's reading
the case files
and he comes across the one of the girl who's the same age and she's sick. And he's kind of like, why aren't her parents helping? And Aaron Brockovich or Julia Roberts is there being like, because they're sick too. And they can't.
Yeah.
This is one thing they can't do, but I can help them with. And he's kind of just like, I'll bring you home some breakfast. And
yeah, you're
just
like, he gets it.
And he's
he
just like, it. That's the moment where he's just like, oh, my mom is helping the greater good. My mom's looking at the bigger picture and stuff like that. And so.
But I think, again, like that goes back to Aaron's skill of like, she can break this down for her 10-year-old son where he can fully understand to be like, oh, this is why she's working so much and so hard. But also she goes to like high lawyer, like high powered lawyers, and she can show off and be like, you don't think I'm no good? Like, I'll fucking show you.
Yeah.
I'll show you what I'm capable of doing. And we come back to the fuck you moment. She gets about four fuck you moments.
With those lawyers?
With those lawyers where you're just like, every time you're like, you're sort of like, I understand that they're on the same team, but also like, fuck yeah. Like, like these guys suck.
The first time she meets the lawyers, I think it must be the first time, and the woman lawyers looking at the cases, and well, you're kind of missing some key information.
Yeah.
You just don't know what to ask for. And so like, we'll have to go back and redo everything. Aaron's there being like, well, what did I miss? Well, we have no phone numbers. What phone number do you want? Like, pick any of them. I'm sitting there being like, there's 400 people I think they're talking about.
Yeah.
And sure enough, she lists one off and this is their kids and this is their problems and yada, yada. And you are there being like, well, done. Like,
how many phone numbers, if I asked you right now, could you rattle
could off? Could I list off? Our home, what was our dad's home number? They subsequently have gotten rid of their phone number.
It doesn't exist, so that doesn't count.
I know my best friend, or my friend that I've known since I was 3 years old. I know her phone number still. Now know Chris's phone number and mom's cell phone. So,
is that five?
Five, six? Maybe six.
Yeah, that's not bad.
What about you?
I got two.
The home number?
The home number and my phone number. That is it. Like everything else, fuck if I know. I lose that phone, I'm stranded.
You're dead.
I am stranded. That's
your way out of society. Yeah. You lose your phone, you might as well go live in a mountain then.
Exactly. It's obviously Aaron's show. This is her movie.
Yeah.
The side character of note, though, is Ed Masri, the lawyer who hires her and is like her boss. Eventually, like, it's more of a friendship sort of. Well, I guess, like, he never stops being her boss, but... They certainly sort of complement each other in terms of
he
can handle this stuff and she can handle that stuff.
They almost become more like partners
in
a way.
In a way. What'd you make of Ed? How did you find Ed as a character?
I thought he played such a good job at playing the old lawyer who clearly just comes and does the bare minimum. Like, I think he's
I don't know if he does the bare minimum. Besmirch Ed like that.
But clearly is just doing enough to get him to the retirement stage. Yeah. Like, I feel like he had his date in mind that he was going to retire, and he was just working towards that date. He wasn't going to kind of do more or less than he really needed to do. And I think that's why this pro bono case was just only ever going to be one small pro bono case. Like, I don't think he was going to look into it any further
than
this. And stuff. But yeah, no, I thought he did a great job.
I think the key scene with him is he gets that scene in the courtyard with Aaron where she says something about he doesn't work hard enough or whatever.
Yeah.
And he sort of lays out the things about him that she doesn't know, which is, you know, what he's done and what he's gone through and, you know, his life. And you're sort of like, oh, like this guy is, it's not that he, like you say, he's counting down the days. I don't necessarily know if he's counting down the days, but I think he is looking back on his life and has sort of said, I've done enough.
Yeah.
I'm not really looking to push the envelope anymore. I kind of just, you know, I'm happy with my level that I've hit. I don't really want any more. I definitely don't want any less, but I'm good here.
Yeah.
Whereas I think Aaron is constantly trying to push him to sort of be like, let's go bigger. Like, what's the next step up? What's the next, like, you know, what if we got 600 people instead of 400 people?
Yeah.
Like, what would that mean? And she's always kind of trying to push it. And he's, you know, for the beginning anyways, he's kind of hesitant to that. But I love that, like, he plays sort of exhausted.
Yeah.
So well. Like, exhausted with her. Where I think, like, he definitely sees the pros to Aaron. And the way that she works and what she's able to accomplish and, you know, that sort of stuff. but he is constantly exhausted by her because she is always pushing for more. That you're just like, I get it, man. I get it. Like, she's not the easiest person to hang out with.
No, I'm thinking of the bundt cake scene. Like, oh, yeah. When yeah. The case has just kind of started, and I think they now have two couples.
They have a couple.
I think
they
maybe two or three.
Yeah,
I think.
They have a few, yeah.
And one of the guys of the couple is kind of looking at him being like, well, like, why should we sign with you? And he's like, well, because of this, and like, my fee, though, is 40% of the winnings.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I turned to mom and I was like, that seems really steep, like 40% of the winnings. And she's like, well, just wait a second.
Yeah, she's seen this before. Yeah.
She's like, just wait a second. And then Julia Roberts does the explaining. It's only 40% of the winnings. If they got nothing in the settlement or no winnings, he's done all of this work for nothing.
Yeah.
And for no payment. And I was sitting there being like, okay, like, I kind of get the pro. It was the pro bono.
Yeah.
I was like, how's it pro bono if you're getting money at the end of this and stuff? And so I think that's a really good scene to kind of explain lawyers and that maybe they are hard and cold and various things throughout life, but it's because they probably do so much work and get nothing at the end of it sometimes.
Yeah,
so.
I wouldn't worry too much about lawyers out there. I think they're doing okay. But yes, I think it goes to help
kind of humanize him.
Humanize or, yeah. Ed a little bit, especially in their eyes where they're sort of like, okay, like, he is going to fight hard for us because the harder he fights for us, the better he will get as well. Like, you know, we're all kind of in the same boat here. So the more he gets for us, the more he gets for himself. And so therefore, you know, you're sort of like, okay, like, Ed's going to, he's going to go all the way with this. He's going to go as far as he possibly can with it. I think the thing, like, obviously Erin wasn't and isn't a lawyer, but having her not be a lawyer in terms of the townspeople's eyes, and I think ours as like an audience helps to sort of be like, she's not full of shit.
Yeah.
Because I think we, like, anyone watching a movie or a TV show or whatever, and it's all about lawyers, there is that little part of you where you're sort of like, fuck these guys. Like, they are just, you know, talking out of both sides of their mouths and things like that. Whereas because, A, we've seen the struggles that Erin does go through at the beginning of the movie. And then when she eventually does meet the townspeople, like, you know, the big case starts 30 minutes into the movie or whatever. You're sort of like, no, she's genuine. Like, she's basically one of them. And that helps bring them into the fold, right?
I think for me as an audience too, because she wasn't a lawyer, they end up having to explain things to her.
Which then explains it to you.
Which then explains it to me and stuff. And so, like, it made understanding the case a lot easier. Because I find that sometimes with some science movies, like, I think sometimes in Oppenheimer, I got confused about the science.
Yeah.
Because they were science guys talking to science guys, so they didn't need to, like, explain it or whatever. And so with this, it was easier for me to follow the, like, lawyer law stuff.
So, slight digression here. Might cut this out. But you and Mom recently watched Tar. And then Mom and I have subsequently gone and watched Maestro, which is coming out in a week or whatever. And they're obviously both about classical music and composers and things like that. A world that we know nothing about.
Quite literally nothing. Yeah.
Literally nothing about. And I think both you and Mom sort of talked about the fact that you felt a little lost with Tar at times when they started to go into the whole composer thing and the world of classical music because you didn't really understand what they were talking about.
Yeah.
And I think
you thought we were nuts for not understanding.
Well, but I thought you guys were nuts because the movie for me was, it's not about classical music. Tar could be, she could be a road paver for, like, you know what I mean? Like, it wouldn't matter. To me, it doesn't matter what she's doing because the movie's not about what she's doing as, like, a profession.
Okay.
The movie's about her as a character, right? And so I did have that conversation a little bit with Mom at Maestro where I was sort of like, now, do you feel the same way about this that you felt about Tar and whatnot? And so, like, long story short, scenic route to this point.
Okay.
Is that something that you get hung up on with sort of lawyer movies where, like, if they start talking jargon because you don't understand it, you get lost and therefore kind of maybe stop liking or tune out for a bit?
A little bit. Not necessarily stop liking. It might be that I have to pause it and kind of look things up.
Okay.
Or like I get kind of out of the moment of the movie because I'm sitting there trying to be like, okay, well, what do they mean? Like I was just reading a book and they talked about hand canceling stamps or hand stamping or something, envelopes. And I actually had to put down my book and look that up because I was like, clearly this is important enough that they've brought it up, but I don't understand what it is.
Right.
And so like it takes me out of the flow of the movie or the book because I need to understand that. So
I tend to watch these things and sort of be like Aaron Brockovich isn't about the, it's not really about the case or the trial of this ecological disaster. It's about Aaron. And it's like about what she is going through and like, how is she balancing life and how is she getting this self identity of like a good mom and a hard worker and somebody who's like worth a damn. That's what the story to me is about. It's not about the legal stuff at all, really.
And like, I get that, but I think for me, I could get that this time because they do explain.
Right. Okay.
So like, because she's not a lawyer and they explain to her, like I've said, they then subsequently explain to us. So then I'm always in the moment because I'm sitting there being like, well, if I'm in Aaron's shoes, I now understand the hexagonal
right
carbonate or yeah. whatever it is
yeah.
and stuff. And so I'm just like, the next time they talk about it or they bring it up, it's like, oh, that's what that was.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And stuff. So it's never, I never kind of get lost or I can pick up on sometimes the smaller sentences that are shared. So like when Ed comes back to her after she gets fired and he's like, well, there was a note from whoever at Caltech or wherever they were.
That she was. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he reads it and he's confused. I'm sitting there being like, oh yes, because she's already gone and talked to him and
right.
she now understands and she knows from the reports that the level was whatever. So like I'm able to kind of make connections before the movie makes it for us sometimes.
Do you know anything about PG&E?
No.
So PG&E are just like, they're the bad guys in the story. And I actually really love that, like, they're not even a character. Like,
they're just a big corporation.
They're just a corporation. Like, we see their lawyer representatives at one point, and I think we see one sort of, like, executive who comes in really early on to kind of half negotiate.
Yeah.
But, like, for the most part, like, we basically don't see anyone who works there. We, you know, they don't really interview anybody who's there. They don't interview any of the executives. They don't, you know, all those things that I'm sure in real life did happen. We don't focus on that at all.
Yeah,
no. All you need to know is that they are a faceless corporation who are poisoning these people. That's it.
Are PG&E still around?
So PG&E, like, can't get away from controversy.
Oh, God. Okay. So,
like, if you go on their, like, Wikipedia page, it's basically, like,
controversy after controversy.
Yeah, yeah. It's, like, okay. a yearly thing. Like, I hope none of their lawyers are listening. But, yeah, like, the big one that I always kind of remember when I, you know, go watch this movie or whenever their name comes up is, like, all those forest fires that were in California there 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
That basically, like, burned the entire state. That was PG&E.
Oh, God. So,
the amount of money that they have paid out of negligence, out of cutting corners, out of whatever, like, is astronomical. And, yeah, like, they're a good movie villain because you're sort of like, yeah, these guys fucking suck.
Because what, like, they're water, like, are they a water company?
I think they're a little bit of anything. I think they're mostly energy, I think.
Energy, okay.
Yeah, they're mostly energy. And so, but I think they probably have fingers and toes and a lot of pies. And, like, it's just one of those things about this movie. Like, this movie's now 23 years old, and the story is another 10 years older than that.
Yeah.
And it's like, because P&E have continued to suck, it's continued to be relevant. You know what I mean? Like, you sometimes get stories like these or movies like these where the company then is, like, defunct or goes bankrupt and they don't exist anymore. And you're sort of like, well, like,
not going to go watch it again. Cause... Well,
but it's not even like, how bad were they really?
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? But because these guys have continued to be bad, when you go back and watch this movie, you're just like, oh yeah, fuck those guys. Like, those guys have been bad for 60 years. Like,
you could just change the story for a forest fire one.
Oh, yeah. Oh, like... easily. And, like, if you read their page, like, Aaron has gone after them countless times and gotten money out of them countless times. So, yeah, she's basically made that her crusade is these guys and going after sort of these corporations who cut corners for a tiny bit more profit and things like that.
Speaking of, like, kind of how they are faceless, their first lawyer that comes in, the T.J. Thine, I think is how I would say his name, him just kind of coming in and being one guy by himself, all geeky and tiny, I was just like, oh, sweetie. Like,
well, yeah, I don't know. Like, they're trying to play some games, right? Like, they're trying to send somebody in who's not going to intimidate you.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So, we should probably talk about the fact that this was, you know, this was a big Oscar thing, especially for Julia Roberts. It was her first Oscar. It's her only Oscar.
I was going to say, I think last week you kind of said it wasn't much of a race for this particular year. Yeah. Like, was it everybody knew before this came out she was going to get it? Or the minute people saw this, everybody was like, oh, this is Julia's year. Well, like, she's got it.
I think there was, like, she'd been nominated, I think, three times beforehand or twice before. But she'd obviously been, like, an A-list star, like I was saying, for, like, 10, 12 years at this point. And I think the conversation was kind of a, like, when is she going to do it? Like, we know she's going to get one. When is she going to do it? And I think when they saw the story, like, you know, at that point, Erin Brockovich, this whole story was, like, 6, 7 years old. Like, it was pretty fresh. And so it's like, okay, big name star, big role. You know, Steven Soderbergh at that point was a big name director. So it's sort of like all the stars were aligning, I think, where she was probably the front runner at the beginning of the year. Like, we do our Oscar thing and we pick movies before anyone's seen them. We're just doing that on reputation. And I think based on reputation, people were like, okay, she's probably the front runner. And then they saw the movie and they're just like, fucking just give it to her.
Okay.
Like, just give it to her now. Because we know, like, she was the front runner coming in. It's a fucking great performance in a great movie that, like, is we're clearly going to be talking about for the next, you know, 6, 7, 8 months, however, until Oscar time. Sort of like, she's not going away.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so, yeah, like, she just sort of rode into the sunset with this. And it was just like, yeah, there was, like, no question that she was going to win. So, like, when you look at some of the other actors nominated with her, like Joan Allen's great. I've never seen The Contender, so I don't really know anything about that movie. Juliette Binoche, I think, had already won one.
Okay.
Ellen Burstyn, who's, like, phenomenal in Requiem for a Dream, I think she had already won one. And then Laura Linney in You Can't Count, or You Can Count on Me. It's like I've seen that. It's a great movie and she's great, but it's really small.
Oh, okay.
It's a really small movie. And so I think, yeah.
It was kind of
hers to lose, and, like, she was not going to lose this.
Yeah, because I'm now looking at kind of some of the other ones. Steven Soderbergh was up for both Erin Brockovich and Traffic.
Yeah, he beat himself in Best Director, which is, like, funny because I think at the time, like, if you go through and sort of, Erin Brockovich had some nominations. Traffic had some nominations. I think people looked at Traffic as, like, the bigger achievement. But I think over the years, people have been like, oh, no, Erin Brockovich is way, way better. Like, it's way more entertaining, but it still has, like, a message and a story. It's obviously got the performance from Julia Roberts. Like, I think Erin Brockovich has elevated in estimation, whereas Traffic has come down a little bit.
Okay.
Not that my opinion is the opinion.
Well, for some people it would be.
Well, yeah.
and sometimes you make it the opinion.
Yeah, but so. I'll be honest. My opinion is not even, like, the opinion that I put most faith into. But Erin Brockovich, for me, is in Steven Soderbergh's top five. I've seen 30 movies from Steven Soderbergh.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it's sitting at number five, whereas Traffic is down to, like, 17. So, like, okay. It gives you, and, like, Traffic is dropping. I watched Traffic in probably 15 years, and I don't really care to. Whereas Erin Brockovich, like, I clearly watched this 4 years ago, and I was fucking pumped to watch it again.
Is Oceans, or one of the Oceans, your top one?
Yeah, Oceans is number one. Ocean's Eleven is one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So for Julia Roberts, she was nominated for Steel Magnolias for supporting in 1990, and then 91 for Pretty Woman for Best Actress.
Right. So then, yeah, so this was her third nomination then.
Yeah.
Like we kind of already pointed out, like the 90s did get a little dicey for her. I think she made a lot of money, but there was a couple duds
yeah.
in that lineup.
So this would have been the well-deserved Oscar win. I feel like she has won more, but she hasn't.
No, no.
Like, she hasn't been nominated since 2014, but I guess right now she's kind of in a nice... I think she's gone back to kind of rom-coms.
She's kind of gone back to her bread and butter. So. She's definitely, like, she's taken a step back. Like, we can't get around that. We can't talk about Julia Roberts without acknowledging the fact that, like, female actors do age out.
Yeah.
Pretty young of roles. Like, people are not writing roles for 50-year-old women.
Nope.
So, you know, that's why they go to TV. Yeah. And Julia Roberts done some TV over the years. So, yeah, like, there's obviously that as well. But, like, I think there is a diehard contingent of people, I think, that when they hear Julia Roberts is in something, they're certainly interested.
Yeah, I would agree. I think the one, like, that Ticket to Paradise that came out...
I was like, that was a COVID last one, year? Wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, we're 2023 right now. Yeah, last year. It was one that I had in my head to kind of check out. I think I've now watched it on a plane to or from Ireland at some point. But it's because it's her and George Clooney.
Yeah.
And, like, I love them in Ocean. So I was just like, I think
it'll fire
just,
it up.
Yeah. Like, it'll just be a nice, fun movie. So.
Well, she's got the new one on Netflix this week. So we'll see if that, you know.
Oh, yeah. Leave the World Behind.
Yeah. We'll see if that cracks the Netflix top 10 or whatever. I think it's all manufactured, that stuff.
You don't believe their top 10?
Well, it's not that I don't believe their top 10. I would like to see the numbers on that. Okay. I think Netflix used the top 10 as a marketing device to sort of be like, here, watch this thing. Instead of it actually reflecting what people are watching.
Okay, kind of like Magician. Like, watch over here. Or
yeah.
Like, something's happening over here.
Yeah. Should we tease next week?
Yeah. So, finally a Christmas movie, which is my favorite kind of movies of the year. I will say I did have a hard time picking the one from the 2000s, because my top Christmas movie is Santa Claus, which is in the 1990s.
Okay. So, I've never seen the Santa Claus.
What?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I've never seen it. I was out with friends a couple weeks ago, and that came up, and they were all like gobsmacked that I hadn't seen it. And I was like, man.
I watch it every year. I tend to watch it when I'm wrapping presents. But yeah, I'll sit down and I put on the first one for sure. The other two or three that have come out are bad. But because I watch one, I end up watching all of them. So I, if nothing, love a movie marathon of a certain kind. So yeah, so it's a Christmas movie from the 2000s. And actually my first DVD that I ever owned.
The first one that you ever bought with your own money?
No, so I got it for Christmas when we got our DVD player.
Okay.
So
okay.
Santa brought both the DVD player and this DVD for me, so.
Was that, like, marked to you in that card from Santa, or was it marked to both of us?
The DVD player or the DVD?
The DVD.
I think the DVD was for me. I think you got your own.
Okay.
So.
Well, imagine what I got. That might have been the year I got the Godfather trilogy.
2001?
Yeah, kind of explains this whole dynamic here. You're getting this movie, which, you know, we'll reveal next week.
Yeah.
And I got the Godfather trilogy pretty early.
Did you really?
Yeah, pretty early. Pretty early. I want to say about maybe 12.
Oh my God.
12, 13 years old. I got, yeah. And I was pumped. I was so pumped.
And then, is there a challenge for me next week?
Yeah, so next week we're doing one more challenge. I'm going to squeeze this in before the end of the year. And that is for you to watch Citizen Kane. So I have brought you my copy of Citizen Kane. So there's no excuses. I will need it back because I'm going to rewatch it as well.
Oh, okay. So I have to watch it before.
Yeah.
Okay.
Try and watch it and then get it back to me. And I'll probably try and rewatch it as well. But yeah, like, long regarded the greatest movie of all time.
Should we do an Instagram poll and see if it actually is?
Yeah, well, yeah, Orson Welles didn't show up on that greatest directors list, so these people are obviously Mankiewicz fans. But yeah, I'll be curious. This is, like, it's an older one. This is, like, 41? 1941? Okay. So this will be one of the older movies you've ever seen.
Yep.
very important in terms of like what he was able to do and sort of, I'll rewatch it again, but the last time I watched it, I was like, oh, he doesn't necessarily invent any sort of like filmmaking techniques, but he certainly perfects the ones that they already had.
Okay.
That to a degree that nobody else was necessarily doing. So yeah, I'd be curious to see what you make of Citizen Kane. Kind of a Christmas movie as well. There's a little bit of Christmas in there.
Yeah, I think next week we're having a discussion on what classifies as a Christmas movie. Yeah, so.
Well, yeah, we'll get into that next week. But until then, we'll see everybody next week.
See you then.